Hello and welcome to another episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. This episode brings us around to the home stretch of examining Holmgren's 12 Principles of Permaculture. After this one, we've only got one more to go. Before I begin, though, I'd like to thank everyone who's been sending in questions for future episodes. If you have one of your own, please send it to show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Those episodes are going to begin as soon as we're done with the next show, Principle 12, Creatively Use and Respond to Change. This time around, though, it's going to be Principle 11, Use Edges and Value the Marginal. Now, Holmgren subtitles this principle, Don't Think You Are on the Right Track Just Because It Is a Well-Beaten Path. Hopefully in a local way. I mention that here, even though I've left it out for many of his other principles, because in this case, for this principle, I think that both descriptions serve as good reminders that in order to accomplish this work of permaculture, we need to be looking for any and all resources that we can use to build resiliency into our system so that we can provide all our human needs locally while supporting other life and maintaining the integrity of our home, the earth. And two of those places that we should be looking are to the edges and the marginal. Now, edges represent the coming together of two or more regions of varying characteristics, and that overlap between them offers a greater diversity than either one individually. And the marginal are those which are overlooked because they have little perceived value, but they offer unique opportunities if we can find an advantageous way to integrate them or restore them and build their value. I want to examine both of these by giving examples of what they are so that you can begin looking for them and begin considering how you can convert them to your purpose. As I mentioned, our edges are where two different areas meet. On a large scale, these are where bioregions come together. And examples of this could be any area where land meets the sea, be that at a river delta, a bay like the Chesapeake or Bay of Islands, or where two diverse land features meet, be that the plains and the forest, or those foothills where plains meet the mountains. The largest inland example of this that I could find, and I apologize for my pronunciation on this, is the Sahel in Africa that separates the Sahara Desert from the savannah. If you want a good deal more information on this, do a search for ecotones, ECOTONES, which is the term used in ecology for this meeting of bioregions. Now, I wouldn't expect you to use these large-scale edges directly in your design unless you live in one, be that on the beach at the ocean or shore of a river, but rather I look at these as patterns that you can use in order to find similar details on a smaller scale in your own location. And when it comes to these human scale regions, those that can be visited and experienced directly, whether we open our front door and step out into our yard, or go for a walk, or maybe even a drive, these places where areas meet and change can happen very quickly over short distances. And these include the shape, contour, and steepness of a slope, soil type, the edges of ponds, the banks of streams, if you have variation in soil drainage, or where the landscape changes from lawn to road or woods. That mention of road I bring up because there are a lot of edges in our built environments as well, be that the Devil Strip, that little bit of lawn that's found in some cities that separates the sidewalk from the road, or undeveloped lots sitting amid buildings, or places that have gone unmaintained and are now beginning the march back to nature. And that you can find on really small scales, like the crack in a sidewalk as a plant comes up, or if you're walking down an alley to find a tree growing between the asphalt and the foundation. And these can be places where you can implement urban permaculture and not need a suburban lot or a couple acres out in a rural area, but apply it into the city where you live, in the spaces you call home. To expand on these examples a little, I'd like to share with you the edges that I have on my property. Now, the entire property slopes from the north and west sides down towards the southeast corner. And this change of elevation isn't great, but it is definitely noticeable. And as I've mentioned on many occasions in the past, the eastern half and a part of the southern edge of my property is a floodplain and receives seasonal inundations from the stream that sits on the southern edge. And that stream goes down all along the southern border, and then wraps around my neighbor's property to the east and covers the eastern edge of his property as the stream heads north. And then south of the stream is a ridge directly behind my house, so that if I'm looking out my back windows, I'm staring at trees climbing up beyond the height of the house. And then along the north is the road that runs in front of my home, with a mountain in the near distance. To the west is a wooded lot that butts directly up against the yard. That western part of the property is that hill where my home sits, and the woodlot comes all the way up to that hill. But separating the two is a rather steep slope, 4 to 6 feet high. So here these edges represent woods to the west, neighbor to the east, road to the north, stream to the south. And that doesn't even touch on what's in the property itself, such as the soil change, which is all over the place. Some sections are clay, other sections have very high sand content, and the whole thing's rocky. Not to count that my front yard is primarily made of fill that wasn't really clean when it went in. And these can all change within just a step or two as you move around the yard. And with these examples from my property, here's homework assignment number one for this episode. Using your observation skills, I'd like you to identify the edges in the landscape around you. If you're a homeowner or rent a place with some property to it, what borders the property itself? If you're in the city and are an apartment dweller or live in an old brownstone, what are the edges around where you are in this urban environment that would be different from the suburban or rural setting? And then once you've identified the edges, are there ways that you could use them to increase the amount of diversity around you? Two little things that I've done to try to increase this edge and change what this land has to offer its other inhabitants has been to leave my yard waste in piles. I put little piles of grass clippings in various places on the lawn, particularly near my plants. And this creates a covered area rather than open lawn that offers shade and increases the near soil humidity. And I found that this has turned into a great habitat for a wide range of spiders. And then the woody brush that I've collected from my tree trimmings last fall, I took and I put them into their own piles in a few different places. And I've noticed quite a number of birds using them as perches and hangouts and hideouts. And I'm interested to see this year what, if any, larger mammals move in. I'm hoping something interesting shows up. With the opossums and raccoon this year, it's been an interesting exposure to wildlife here. Ones that just a few years ago I wouldn't have imagined existed here. I just never saw them and never recognized them. As we recognize and build these edges, then there's the marginal land to consider. And this includes land that's difficult to use for some reason, be it because it's a floodplain and has water coming onto it regularly, it's a steep hillside, or maybe it's just an area that's remote and hard to access, or cut off because of some geographic feature. Or maybe it has conditional issues, such as erosion, or soil that's been stripped of its nutrients and now is little more than dirt, or climate concerns because it's too hot or cold, wet, or arid. Or maybe it's exposed and has a lot of wind that could damage and stunt your plants. And I know that I've mentioned my flooding issues in the past and some of the things I'm working with to take advantage of that. And in cases like that, what are ways that you can think of to mitigate the issues and turn them into something positive? And I mentioned this idea when we were identifying vectors in the conversation about zones, sectors, and vectors a while back. And that same thought process applies to the marginal in looking at it and trying to turn that problem into a solution that's useful to us. One major point that I want to bring up about marginal land is that there are places that just are simply not valued because of the problems that are seen there. There's also land that's become degraded and made marginal due to human interaction, and in many cases are polluted in a way that radically changes how we can use it. If it's radioactive or deeply toxic, it may require very expensive and thorough cleanup, or that we need to abandon it entirely. And if that happens to be the case, then we need to leave some warning signs to keep people away, and to let them know of the danger while we allow time to heal those wounds. And this pollution issue and contamination of soil is one that's of particular interest to me because it has a direct impact on the urban agriculture program I'm working with. The entire city of Harrisburg, as I understand it, is considered a contaminated site. And farmers who came in to speak with the head of the program have told her directly, don't dig in the soil or plant anything in it because of the risk of what may be there. And knowing that, the information limits the amount of growing space we have to use because of the need to build raised beds and import clean growing material. And if we want to grow anything that's deeply rooted, then that just means that our beds have to be that much deeper and the more material we need to bring in. And to include some kind of a barrier between the old soil and these new and the new raised beds. It's brought up a lot of questions for me about what we can and can't plant, how we have to plant it, especially with really wanting to do an urban orchard and do a model installation that could be replicated elsewhere throughout the city. And that's led me to do a lot of research into the effects of contaminated soil and food crops, both from plant and human health perspectives. The information on the impact to plants is pretty straightforward, that it can affect growth, nutrient absorption, and generally you just don't have as healthy of a plant as you would in good growing conditions, as we would expect. The information, though, on the possible impacts to human health vary considerably, and for every answer that I find, it just opens up more questions about what is and isn't considered safe. The literature I've found, especially when it comes to lead contamination, are numerous, but each one gives different numbers on what are acceptable and unacceptable lead levels, and then how to remediate that. But so far, what I've found indicates that generally, if you want to grow food in contaminated soil, leafy greens are not a good idea, because the leaves are where the plants are going to concentrate the pollutants. And with root vegetables, it's not so much the root itself taking in these toxic materials that we have to worry about, but that they carry dirt on them. And if they're not well cleaned, they're not well scrubbed, then that ingestion of the dirt can include substantially more lead, arsenic, heavy metals than if you were to eat that piece of food itself, which poses a pretty big risk to children who are learning to work the land and dig that soil. I know when I was a kid, I used to run down whenever the spring onions would come up, and I'd just tear them right out of the ground. Wouldn't even worry about the dirt, the roots, anything, and I'd just munch those until they're gone, and then grab another one. And if you're teaching children about good, wholesome food and fresh foods, I'd rather they have the opportunity to go out there and pull that carrot and just enjoy it for what it is than to be warning them about, oh, you have to make sure you scrub it. Okay, now that it's scrubbed, peel the skin. All right, now we've got to take all this out, and it can't go into the compost heap because it's got some issues. I'd rather they just go out and be able to pull it up and eat it, enjoy it for what it is, in their childhood at the same time. With the leafy greens and roots, they appear to be the most at issue. If you look at vining plants like melons, squashes, cucumbers, or your trees, shrubs, fruiting plants, they appear to have a much, much lower risk. But the data out there that I have so far is pretty inconclusive, which is going to lead me to continue my research. If anyone out there is an agronomist or a horticulturist who's dealt with this kind of issue and can provide me with some clear information, please let me know. It's a really complicated topic, and though I trust the sources the information comes from because it's from the land-grant universities here in the United States and their state extension offices, which are usually pretty reliable, the information is just so varied, I'm not sure what is correct. As an analyst, I'm just kind of doing this pull and search, trying to find the right answers. And the meta-analysis of all this isn't quite as conclusive as I'd like. Once we're aware of these issues in the marginal areas, I think we need to consider restoration, especially land that could be arable. And it's a place where, if I could, I'd love to see more research done and permaculture methods applied to. It can start with some really basic things, like doing riparian repair along streams and rivers to plant that buffer of trees and woody plants and ground covers to minimize the damage that's done to the bank, and to restore our wetlands to help filter the land-based runoff and protect our waterways. But if we want to do more complex remediation of soil, two methods that are really interesting to me are phytoremediation, which is using plants to pick up and filter these toxins, and to use fungal mycelium to pick them up and digest them and transform them. And fungal remediation is such a neat idea, and it's put forth by the mycologist Paul Stamets, And the place where I first ran across it and I returned to is his book Mycelium Running. Mycelium, of which mushrooms are the fruiting body, can uptake and metabolize a really wide range of chemicals in the environment, including petrochemicals. There's an example in Mycelium Running where I think it's oyster mushrooms are fed oil, and I think it's over a 2-week period, they actually absorb and digest all that oil, changing color from nice and white to these just kind of sickly gray things, and then they turn back to white. And it's really neat, because they just eat this up. And if anyone listening has or can raise $2 million to invest in this way to save the earth, if you can send me a little, it'd be appreciated, and then pass the rest on to Mr. Stamets and his work to help foster more research and get the word out there. It has the potential to radically change the way we're able to tackle many of the environmental problems that are out there by utilizing this tool that's provided out there in nature. There's a lot of information available in phytoremediation for free out there on the web. And as I say, Stamets' excellent book, Mycelium Running. And between those two, I think there's enough material that you could spend the rest of your life studying one, let alone both. I'll provide some links to more information in the show notes, including Paul Stamets' TED Talk, which covers the basics of how he thinks mushrooms can save the earth. And that brings us to homework assignment number 2. Can you identify marginal areas in the place where you live? What would you add to my list? Things that I didn't mention, or that come to mind because of the unique setting that you live in. And then, what ways do you think they could be used as they exist now, as they are? Is there a way that you could turn that problem into an advantage without having to change the landscape, but changing the way that you think about interacting with it? If any of these areas are degraded or polluted, how would you consider restoring them? For now, that covers what I wanted to touch on about this principle, use edges and value the marginal. As you may have noticed, in this episode, I didn't touch on anything other than land and land use. Most of the time, I try to give you some community examples for how you can build that as well using these principles. But I did that for a reason, because as your last homework assignment, what I'd like you to do is to use this principle to look at your own community. Where are its edges? Who and what do you think are currently being marginalized or pushed to the margins where you are? Taking the ethics, earth care, people care, and limit consumption and growth, what do you think can be done to improve this in a way that is meaningful and takes the entire situation into account? With that, I'd like to say thank you for joining me again for another episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. If you could take 2 minutes and do 2 things for me to help spread the word about the show, it'd really help. Take 1 minute and tell a friend. Share the show with them, whether it's this episode or another one that you enjoyed. Also, leave a review on your favorite podcast site. And, as you've heard from me in the past, this show is funded by listener contributions. So stop by the website and make a donation. You'll find a link on the right-hand side of the main page at thepermaculturepodcast.com. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.